shirt. Ankenbrand says she's just overwhelmed by all the destruction.
Our reputation, the buildings, our hearts, it's just been devastating.
All up and down Ferguson's Main Street downtown, business owners have been cleaning up broken glass and boarding up windows. Natalie Du Bois opened Natalie's Cakes and More less than 6 months ago.
The vanilla with the chocolate fudge, the strawberry shortcake.
Du Bois says vandals tried to break her store windows three times before finally succeeding. She says they stole bakery products and equipment, and she worried about filling her Thanksgiving Day orders. She says several volunteers called in to say they would help, and she'll be able to get all of those orders out today.
I'm just thankful. I've cried a lot, and I've prayed a lot, and I'm just grateful for just the love of the people. It's really been shown in so many kind of ways.
Protesters in the region, meantime, are hoping to shake up the establishment. They're calling for boycotts of stores on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Ferguson.
The Environmental Protection Agency had one last item of work before going on Thanksgiving holiday. It proposed some new regulations announced yesterday. Those regulations are aimed at cutting ozone-depleting emissions from power plants and factories. And almost as soon as they were announced, major business groups began warning the tougher standards could hurt the economy. NPR's John Itzty reports.
Since 1980, ozone pollution has fallen by a third in the U.S., but the EPA is required by law to review the science underlying air quality regulations every 5 years. As she introduced the tougher standard Wednesday, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said the new rule would better protect the respiratory health of Americans.
Kids can grow up healthier, and their parents and their grandparents can live longer, healthier lives as well. For example, we estimate that meeting a level of 70 parts per billion would prevent an estimated 330 missed school days.
And McCarthy said it would also prevent 750 premature deaths a year.
Certainly manufacturers want clean air and clean water, just like everybody else.
Ross Eisenberg of the National Association of Manufacturers says the problem is that the technology to meet the proposed standard isn't available.
Manufacturers innovate. We always do. And this statute requires us to. We're very, very nervous, though, is that, you know, that we're at a point where we may not be able to innovate anymore.
The EPA's McCarthy expressed confidence that industry could meet the new standard, which would take effect over the next two decades. In fact, she said, tougher standards actually drive innovation.
One of the great things about continually updating this is it does spark innovation in new technologies.
McCarthy says the economic equation is that for every dollar of cost to meet the new regulation, there would be $3 in benefits. But that cost-benefit calculation is very speculative, says Howard Feldman of the American Petroleum Institute and Industry Research Group. He says that's precisely because the technology needed to meet the standard hasn't been developed. And Feldman says the new standard could curb growth in some parts of the country that will have a hard time meeting it.
We've seen in many places around the country where businesses have been unable to expand because of air quality standards. And we've seen costs imposed on consumers throughout the nation because of that.
Feldman points to Southern California and the Houston area as places where business costs have escalated because of current regulations. Industry will have a chance to make its concerns known during a three-month comment period. EPA hopes to finalize the rule by next October. However, the new Republican Congress could try to block it. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
And the Pentagon says it wants women in frontline combat roles by 2016. Before that can happen, women have to prove they're up to the task. To that end, the Marine Corps is conducting a year-long assessment, starting with about 100 female Marines training alongside men. Among the drills, they'll be holding 30-pound ammunition boxes above their heads for 2 minutes, plus setting up and dismantling heavy guns. Our Pentagon correspondent, Tom Bowman, brought us a report earlier this week from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and we reached one of those Marines, Sergeant Kelly Brown. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I think most people would think on the outside that the toughest thing for a woman is really physical. I mean, women are smaller. It's as simple as that. How do you approach that? What do you think?
I believe that it's mental. You can train your body to do anything. And with the right frame of mind the determination, you can absolutely accomplish those tasks. Yes, it may be harder, but you just have to work that much harder.
Now, when we say physical, we're talking Marines. We're talking serious physical challenges.
Yes.
What may be the hardest for you to do?
I would say when we work more in the field doing, let's say, a stress shoot where, you know, you're in full combat load, having to do different exercises, then go up and, you know, fire on the line, trying to control your breathing, just getting used to running around with the heavier weight and how you can condition your body to do that.
And heavier weight is how heavy?
80 pounds. We're going to get up to the standard for the rifleman is 114 pounds.
And may I ask how much you weigh?
About 130.
So that's a challenge.
Yes.
Well, you're at the beginning of this. How so far have your male fellow Marines responded?
They have been very supportive. Their mentality is the same. If you can bring to the fight the same thing as the males can, well, then join us. But it's about combat effectiveness. That's their stance, and that's what's most important.
Is it also more than carrying 100 pounds, perhaps, in the hot sun over long distances? I mean, is it also something that is being tested here about one's inner ability to fight the fight and then continue to fight the fight and then fight the fight some more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the same as, you know, a female starting out doing this and then a male starting out doing this. You know, you all have to start, you all have a baseline as a Marine that you start off with and you have to train yourself. That's what we do. We train for the fight. And you eventually get to a point where you can accomplish any mission or accomplish any task.
What about your family? Because you're really talking about taking it as far as it can go.
They're very supportive. I'm very competitive by nature, always have been. I always look for the challenge, look for what I can improve on and take it to the next level. So they support it. They already know I'm going to go for it.
Probably before you did it, right?
Yes.
Let me just ask you a personal question. What's up for Thanksgiving?
I'm going to be seeing my family, spending some time with, I have nieces, and taking my son to go see his family, and just spending time with them and eating some food and playing with all the kids, taking a little mental break and taking care of that aspect.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Sergeant Kelly Brown joined us on the phone from Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. She's one of the first women training for combat roles in the Marines. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:19. Happy Thanksgiving. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Recent big-budget films like Jurassic World and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes were shot in Louisiana. We'll visit Hollywood South at 8:33.
Support comes from Gateway, offering pathways to high in-demand IT jobs that include network security and software and web development, starting pay $50,000 to $70,000 a year. 1-800-247-7122. Choose option 2 and ask for a new student specialist.
By the Yahara String Quartet. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support celebrations of the season. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
Weather today, partly cloudy and unseasonably cold, with most highs in the teens. From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. With oil prices at their lowest level in years, analysts are closely watching today's OPEC meeting in Austria.
With prices down 30% since June, the pressure is on to cut production and prevent further slides. Major Gulf suppliers such as Saudi Arabia, though, are saying this is simply a temporary slide that will correct itself. Analysts say without a production cut, prices could continue to slip.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon in Vienna. Cheaper crude oil continues driving down gasoline prices in the U.S. AAA says regular is now averaging $2.79 a gallon nationwide. Major retailers in the U.S. are opening their doors again this Thanksgiving. They include Target, JCPenney, and Macy's, each trying to get a jump on Black Friday sales. The National Retail Federation predicts fewer holiday shoppers hitting the stores today. Thanksgiving also means NFL football. There are three games on the schedule today, including the traditional matchup in Detroit. NPR's Tom Goldman says this afternoon it's the Lions hosting the Chicago Bears.
NFL Thanksgiving in Detroit began in 1934 with a game between the Lions and Chicago Bears. They've played on the holiday 14 times since then. The Lions are stocked with offensive stars, but ranked just 21st out of 32 teams on offense. Chicago has won two straight after consecutive losses in which the Bears gave up at least 50 points in each game.
I'm Dave Mattingly.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. The state of Wisconsin is suing two Oregon-based publishing groups alleging they ran a subscription scam targeting the elderly. The Department of Justice alleges Liberty Publishers Service and Orbital Publishing Group sent invoices to nursing home residents and others, warning them to renew their subscriptions to periodicals like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but charged far more than the actual cost. The lawsuit asks a judge to bar the groups from continuing such violations of Wisconsin consumer law and demands forfeitures for each violation as well as for targeting the elderly. An executive with the two companies did not return a phone message seeking comment. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has confirmed a new invasive algae called starry stonewort has been found in a lake in Waukesha County. Routine monitoring turned up the European algae in Little Muskego Lake. That algae was found for the first time in the Great Lakes area 31 years ago. The DNR is working with local officials to come up with a response. Federal officials are looking for people to join two Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest Advisory Committees. Both panels work to improve relationships between forest users and advise forestry officials on which projects to undertake and to spend money on. Each committee is made up of 15 members who represent diverse interest groups. Completed applications must be returned to the Forest Service headquarters by December 12th. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate high school prepared for success in college and career. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Thanksgiving, a day to gather with relatives around the dinner table, engage in conversations like this one.
I know how you feel.
You don't know how I feel, and in my opinion, you don't even care.
Well, opinions are like honey. Everybody's got one, and everybody thinks everybody else stinks.
For Christ's sake.
That's a scene from the 1995 film Home for the Holidays. Thanksgiving arguments, often sparked by politics, are a classic part of the dinner table. NPR's Shankar Vedantham often joins us to talk about social science research, and he sat down with our Steve Inskeep to chat about a scientific experiment that might help keep tempers calm at your dinner table.
Okay, so what's the new research?
Well, the research looks at seemingly intractable conflicts, such as the conflicts between Democrats and Republicans, and it shows that besides disagreements about the issues, there's an underlying psychological process that makes a search for common ground really difficult. The research comes from Leanne Young at Boston College, and along with Adam Waits and Jeremy Gingis, she asked Democrats and Republicans about the emotions that motivate them and the emotions that motivate their opponents. Both sides said that they were motivated by positive emotions, such as love or loyalty to their fellow Republicans or their fellow Democrats, but that their opponents were motivated primarily by hate and animosity. Now, this was true of both Republicans and Democrats. Here's Young talking about the Democratic volunteers.
Democrats were much more likely to say that they're motivated by love compared to hate. We then went and asked them how much is the Republican Party motivated by love and hate. And there we found that Democrats were likely to say that Republicans were motivated by their hate of Democrats rather than their love of Republicans.
Okay, so the research says that I'm thinking the worst of the other guy, or more properly, I think that you're thinking the worst of me. I think you hate me, and that colors my perceptions of you.
That's precisely right, Steve. The point that Young and her colleagues are making is that if we believe that our opponents hate us, it's really hard to imagine common ground. So this might be one reason conflicts end up being intractable, not just in politics, but in arguments over the Thanksgiving table. When we feel an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent is out to get us, we do everything we can to defend ourselves against this hate that's coming across the table. What we don't often realize is the person sitting across the table is trying to defend themselves from what they think is our hate for them. So Young and her colleagues think that if we try to see the other side as also being driven by positive emotions such as loyalty or love rather than animosity, the arguments don't disappear, but it takes the sting out of the arguments.
You know, we have a colleague here at work who talks about assuming the best intentions of the other person. I suppose that's the insight here, is to assume the best of intentions of the partisan jerk across the table from me.
That's exactly right, Steve. People live very different lives, and they're coming together for a Thanksgiving meal, so it's not surprising they're going to bring their loyalties to their own groups to the shared dinner. Young told me she hopes to apply the lesson of her study to her own Thanksgiving if an argument happens to break out. Here she is.
In the case of a fiery Thanksgiving debate, it's good to give the benefit of the doubt that this person isn't arguing with me because they hate me. But I would tell myself, hey, you know, they want me to understand their point of view because they think it's right. And this grandparent is motivated by their love of me.
But wait a minute here. Suppose I try so hard to be big about this and to be open-minded and the other person is just a jerk, or I'm afraid the other person is going to be a jerk. What would it take to get the other person to open their minds?
Well, that's a good question, Steve. Young's study actually might point to the solution because she and her colleagues wanted to see if they could do anything to get people to accurately perceive their opponent's point of view. Now, since this is America, they decided to try the old-fashioned approach. They promised volunteers a financial incentive.
Just pay them.
Exactly. They found that when you tell Democrats and Republicans that they stand to earn about $10 if they can accurately describe what's happening in their political opponents' minds, both sides now say the views of their opponents are probably shaped by positive emotions such as loyalty and love rather than hate. I asked Young whether the same technique might work at Thanksgiving dinner tables. Now, I have to say she was very skeptical that this could work, but I say that we should run an experiment, slip a $10 bill under people's plates, and as they sit down, see if that gives us a happy Thanksgiving.
Shankar, there's a little something for you underneath your paper there.
You know, Steve, I always thought so highly of you.
NPR's Shankar Vedantham speaking with Steve Inskeep. You can follow Shankar on Twitter at Hidden Brain, and you can follow this program at Morning Edition. And it's worth considering on this day the millions of people around the world who are refugees fleeing war. Many trying to escape the fighting in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq try to reach Europe. Let's hear now about 700 refugees who spent days stranded and desperate on a broken-down freighter in the Mediterranean Sea. Joanna Kakissis has the story from Athens.
The Greek Coast Guard says the 250-foot cargo ship was headed to Italy when its engine failed. Hundreds of migrants, including women and children, are on board. The Greek Navy towed the ship through rough waters to the port of Ierapetra in southern Crete. The mayor of Ierapetra, Theodosios Kalantzakis, says local authorities and aid workers have turned an indoor basketball court into a shelter. This space can't house them for long, Kalantzakis says, but we had to put them somewhere until they go to migrant detention centers. Most of those on the ship are refugees from Syria and Afghanistan, he says. Amnesty International says that more than 2,500 people have died this year trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to make it to Europe. The number of undocumented migrants arriving in Greece has tripled this year, says Merchant Marine Minister Miltiadis Varvitsiotis.
We estimate that in 2014 we are going to receive more than 30,000 illegal immigrants.
Most refugees from Syria and Afghanistan enter Turkey by land and then travel by sea to Greece and to Greek islands such as Chios, where harbor master Yannis Argyrakis has his staff on patrol 24 hours a day. Some come by speedboats and Turkish smugglers leave them on a beach, Argyrakis says. Others travel on their own on small inflatable boats. And no matter how bad the weather is, he says, they still want to cross. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Ready yourselves!
It's a big movie weekend.
A plan long in the making.
And only the beginning of a big movie season.
You want us to kill the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
Bob Mondello sorts through the explosions, music, and Oscar bait about to invade the multiplex. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Lots of Americans have been traveling through stormy weather to be with family this Thanksgiving, and maybe a few have had to push a stuck car. In Arctic Russia this week, airline passengers got out and pushed a stuck plane. An amateur video captured the bundled passengers giving it their all in minus 60 degrees. Though a tractor is also visible, likely doing the real work, and the airport director sniffed, they just wanted a selfie. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thanks for spending your Thanksgiving morning with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. There's still more to come, including a story that's probably better suited to Halloween, but scientists are trying to understand why some corpses buried in Poland were singled out for special anti-vampire treatments. That's coming up at about 8:45.
Support for WPR comes from Dottie Dumplings Dowry, a family-owned business in downtown Madison, celebrating 40 years, offering a variety of gourmet hamburgers, fresh salads, homemade soup, and more. Open daily for lunch and dinner on Francis Street.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
Hi, this is Connie Beam, Senior Advisor for Planned Giving at WPR. If you're a longtime listener like me and believe in the valuable service that Wisconsin Public Radio provides to our state, join me and make a planned gift so WPR is here for future generations. Include WPR in your will, your trust, or by beneficiary designation. For more information, visit WPRlegacy.org. And thank you.
Well, if you haven't already left for your holiday destination, here's what you can expect today. Partly cloudy skies and unseasonably cold temperatures with most highs in the teens this afternoon, just slightly milder along Lake Michigan. Increasing clouds tonight, the lows around 0 to 12 above. Tomorrow, we'll see highs mainly in the 20s, but it should be a snowy day too with a chance of light freezing drizzle.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. From the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. Learn about the Social Entrepreneurs Challenge at skoll.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Louisiana is known as the Pelican State, but it's now trying out a new nickname, Hollywood South, thanks to some very generous tax credits. More movies are filmed in Louisiana than any other state, California included. From New Orleans, Kate Richardson of member station WWNO has the story.
There's a new synthetic drug at Sagan High. The mission is find a supply.
I think the deal.
The movie 21 Jump Street is about cops busting high school drug dealers. Believe it or not, this movie has a connection to the Dow Chemical Corporation.
Dow Elastomers, global capabilities for flexible membranes.
The connection isn't just synthetic substances. The movie and the company both benefit from Louisiana's motion picture tax credits. For the last 5 years, the state's been luring filmmakers with tax credits worth 30% of production costs. Chris Stelly is the executive director of Louisiana Entertainment, which runs the state's program.
It's quite simple. You spend a dollar in Louisiana, we give you 30 cents back.
So here's how you get from motion pictures to petrochemicals. When 21 Jump Street filmed here, producers spent about $42 million. They received tax credits worth more than $12 million. most productions don't owe taxes to the state of Louisiana because their investors aren't based here. So they can transfer the credits back to the state at a discount, or they can sell their credits to other people who do owe taxes to the state.
We retail tax credits for the motion picture industry, not just in Louisiana, but around the country.
Will French runs a tax credit brokerage called Film Production Capital. He says brokers buy large blocks of credits from movie makers at wholesale prices.
And then the broker will hold the credits until tax season comes and taxpayers are ready to purchase tax credits to pay their own taxes with.
That's how you get to Dow Chemical, which has a massive operation in Louisiana. According to state documents, Dow Chemical paid $2.2 million for $2.5 million worth of 21 Jump Street's tax credits. The difference is what Dow saved in state taxes. The film company turned its credits into cash. The broker made a bit of money, and Louisiana did not make any money in this transaction.
This is a pure loss of tax revenue to the state that Louisiana can't afford at a time when we're having trouble paying for basic services like higher education and keeping emergency rooms open.
Jan Muller is director of the Louisiana Budget Project, a watchdog group.
If you're going to have a film program and you're going to subsidize films, that's one policy decision, but a byproduct of that shouldn't be an extra sweetheart tax break for people who have nothing to do with bringing film activity to Louisiana.
But that transferable aspect is precisely what makes Louisiana so attractive to big productions, says Chris Stelly from the state's film office.
The program wouldn't be successful under the current system without a healthy market for tax credits.
There's no question that big productions bring big money. But while top actor salaries boost a production's spending figures and the size of the subsidy, they don't help the state's budget. Greg Albrecht is chief economist at the state's fiscal office.
What's the goal? I mean, if the goal is for the state fisc to make more money than it puts out, well, no, you're not even coming close, never have been, and never will. If the goal is to, you know, build a film industry and support a certain industry sectors in the economy, well, yeah, I think it's a win in that sense. I mean, without this program, there wouldn't be any, for all practical purposes, there'd be no film production in the state.
There's no talk of getting rid of the tax credit, and little talk of even reducing the subsidy. State lawmakers seem happy to keep paying out of the state's pocket for Louisiana's production boom. For NPR News, I'm Kate Richardson.
And there's a bit of a boom in college football. This year, a dozen colleges have added football programs that are now competing in the NCAA, a record number of new teams. And now, as Tom Michael of West Texas Public Radio reports, even commuter colleges, satellite campuses of bigger universities are getting into the game.
I am privileged and honored to make an announcement about football at UTPB. Yes, you may applaud.
That's the president of the University of Texas at the Permian Basin earlier this fall, announcing the launch of the school's new football team.
Fightin' Falcons,
the school band strikes up a rousing round of Fightin' Falcons. Lyric sheets are passed around because few at this commuter school of about 5,000 students even know there's a school song. After some frantic waving, black, orange, and white balloons are released from the rafters. Here to celebrate is Russell Mormon, a senior in mechanical engineering.
Had no idea it was going to happen until I was driving through campus last spring, and I saw a bunch of Lamborghinis and Ferraris in the parking lot.
Those were the cars of the executives who raised nearly $10 million to set up the program. They include Kirk Edwards. He's from Odessa. He played football as a kid and runs an oil investment company here.
I bet you we bring in 1,000 new students just from the football players that come in and their friends and the bands.
The birth of a new team may not be that surprising in this state, and this city, Odessa, is home to the high school in the movie Friday Night Lights. But there hadn't been college football in this part of Texas until the oil boom created a new class of investors. Again, oil executive Kirk Edwards.
We've been blessed in West Texas with our economy and our oil business, and people give back.
The hope is that football will bring more students and more alumni dollars.
Most people look at the glitz and glamour of a Saturday afternoon and they think that athletic departments are rolling in money.
Welch Suggs is an associate professor at the University of Georgia who has studied the profitability of college football.
There are about two dozen revenue on athletics or via turning net profit. But other regional universities, no.
UT Permian Basin is even diverting the student union fee to fund the football program. And 80% of the student body voted yes on that. Here's UTPB junior Brandon Manning.
I don't know what it is with football, because everyone just wants to have a football team because they love it. I don't know. I love it. I love watching it. I would be a huge fan, even if we're not the best.
The school now needs to hire coaches and recruit players. The T-shirts in the bookstore say Falcons football still undefeated, but players won't take the field until 2016 in a stadium borrowed from a high school off campus.
We've got you in our sights. We're here to win the fight for the orange, black, and white.
For NPR News, I'm Tom Michael in Odessa, Texas.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 8:41. Good morning. Now, speaking of college, the state of Tennessee is offering to pay every student's community college tuition. We'll take a look at that on the Marketplace Morning Report coming up in 10 minutes. Our weather today, partly cloudy and cold, with most highs in the teens, slightly milder near Lake Michigan.
The trick to a great ham is a song, she'd say, and we would sing loud and lustily. I make my ham the way my mother made hers, with lots of talk and love and laughter.
This Thanksgiving, we're in the kitchen with poet Nikki Giovanni. We'll remember her friend Maya Angelou and gather together for a Minnesota blessing from Garrison Keillor. I'm John Burge with music and stories for Thanksgiving. It's Giving Thanks from American Public Media.
Today at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. AAA says this should be the busiest Thanksgiving holiday travel weekend in 7 years. Rain and snow slowed those trying to get away in the Northeast yesterday. Hundreds of airline flights were canceled and thousands more delayed, largely from Washington to Boston. Jim Lavoulis with member station WAMC is out on the roads today in New York and Massachusetts.
The roads seem actually pretty empty. It seems that a lot of people heeded the warnings and gotten their Thanksgiving travel out of the way even on Tuesday. But travel is starting to pick up, but I haven't seen any accidents, so I guess that is a testament to the road crews.
Snow is still falling today in northern New England. British mystery novelist P.D. James has died at the age of 94. That word today out of London. James spoke to NPR's Linda Wertheimer back in 2009 about whether mystery novels are different these days.
I don't think it's changed much with the detective story, although there are different emphases, and the detective story has moved much straighter, closer to the straighter novel. And it's much less an entirely just a puzzle and nothing more than a puzzle.
Her novels included Innocent Blood and her first, Cover Her Face. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is expected back to work on Monday. I'm Dave Mattingly.
And I'm Terry Bell. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. City of Madison is suing the Wisconsin Department of Health over its decision to make police departments take adult male emergency mental health patients to Winnebago Mental Health Institute near Oshkosh instead of Mendota Mental Health in Madison. In many cases, officers will now have to spend an entire shift transporting patients. Madison City Attorney says it's not just because the change puts a strain on city resources, it's also what would be best for individuals. Madison reportedly tried to reach out to the state to settle the situation but got no response. Now the issue will be settled in the courts. State regulators have approved higher rates for tens of thousands of electric customers in Dane County. The Public Service Commission decided yesterday to grant Madison Gas and Electric permission to raise its fixed monthly rates from $10.44 to $19 starting next year. Utility's proposal also calls for reducing its hourly usage rate by a few cents. The PSC estimates the monthly rate increase would actually get up to about $3 a month for the typical residential customer. The utility says increasing the fixed rate helps ensure low-usage customers cover their fair share of maintaining infrastructure. Opponents say the plan punishes customers for conserving electricity. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has chosen the Republican state representatives who will sit on the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Representative John Nygren will be back as co-chairman. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. There is another holiday better suited to talk about vampires, but we sort of can't get our fill. So here is a story about one scientist who found herself analyzing skeletal remains from a vampire graveyard. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has that story.
If you ask Leslie Gregorico what she does for a living, she'll say she's a bioarchaeologist.
A bioarchaeologist is someone who examines ancient skeletal remains to learn more about what life was like in the past.
She's got a lab at the University of South Alabama. Normally, she does chemical analyses of Bronze Age skeletons to understand patterns of trade and human migration. She never expected she'd veer off into vampire studies.
Never. I did not think that that would be the direction my career would go.
That's because, of course, vampires are mythical beings who supposedly come back from the dead to suck the blood of the living. Her vampire adventure started because she has a good friend who was doing research on a graveyard in northwestern Poland. This burial site dates back to the 17th and 18th centuries and was discovered by accident in some farmers' fields outside a village called Drawsko. When archaeologists started excavating the site in 2008, they found something strange.
What they found in that first year was a burial of an individual that had a sickle placed across their neck.
Researchers believe that villagers put this sharp, curved blade around the corpse's neck as an anti-vampire precaution.
It was thought that by placing the sickle across the neck, if the deceased did indeed transform into a vampire and attempt to rise from the grave, that the sharp blade of this instrument would remove the head and prevent that person from attacking the living.
Archaeologists have found other grave sites in Europe where bodies have been given some kind of anti-vampire treatment.
Some have actually iron stakes driven through the left side of the chest.
Others have rocks placed beneath the jaw to prevent the dead from biting the living. But a sickle is really unusual. At Drawsko, scientists have unearthed over 300 graves and found five skeletons with sickles around the neck or abdomen. Gregorica says she was intrigued. For the people who buried all these bodies, what marked those few as potential vampires?
That is the question, and that's what we wanted to figure out as bioarchaeologists. What could the skeleton tell us?
What the historical records told them was that people were suspect if they hadn't been baptized or were the first person to die in an epidemic. But she and her colleagues wondered if other social forces might be at work. They knew that during this period, this region had seen the arrival of lots of immigrants.
We hypothesized that those individuals buried as vampires were targeted because of their outsider status as non-local immigrants.
And this was something she could test for in her lab. She collected teeth from 60 of the skeletons, including ones that had gotten the anti-vampire treatment. Then she did an analysis of the dental enamel. She looked at different types or isotopes of the element strontium.
Strontium isotope values are determined by local geology, and this is going to vary from place to place.
The results, which appear in the journal PLOS One, let her distinguish locals from recent arrivals. And, as it turns out,
contrary to our hypothesis, all of the vampires were local. We found others in the cemetery that were non-local to the region, but they were not buried as vampires.
Gregorica says they'll keep doing more chemistry with these bones to see if they can find any difference that might explain why those five people were buried under a sickle. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Terry Bell. It's about 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. The soundtrack for your Thanksgiving begins at 9, including a harvest suite and cantata by Bach. From 10 till noon, we'll hear some of the Wisconsin's best young musicians with a few highlights from this year's honors concerts. join Stephanie Elkins for the Thanksgiving edition of Morning Classics right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College and is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. To learn more and to take full advantage of our services, visit WGTD.org. To have a program schedule mailed to you, call 262-564-3030.
The UW Jazz Orchestra and featured performer Ingrid Jensen. WPR is pleased to support music education and performance. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
It'll be a white Thanksgiving in much of Wisconsin today, partly cloudy and rather cold, with most highs in the teens, just slightly milder near Lake Michigan. Turning cloudy tonight at lows from 0 to 12 above. A snowy day tomorrow, maybe some light freezing drizzle too, and highs mainly in the 20s.
Support for WPR comes from Associated Bank, offering email, live chat, tweet, or calls to the local service center to connect with an Associated Banker 24/7, 365. AssociatedBank.com, member FDIC. Support also comes from the Madison Community Foundation, dedicated to building permanent endowments that provide funding for community initiatives and connect people for the common good. More information at MadisonCommunityFoundation.org.
When Google recommends Google.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Gura, in for David Brancaccio. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Google is under the spotlight today in Europe. Lawmakers in the European Parliament voted overwhelmingly to recommend antitrust regulators crack down on Google and other search engines, suggesting it could be broken up into smaller, separate units. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Today's vote has been spearheaded by Spanish lawmaker Ramon Tremosa, not because he dislikes Google.
We like Google. We use Google. I use everyday Google in my iPhone.
But he complains Google has a 95% share of the search engine market in Europe, and it's unfair when links to its own products and services come top in its own search results.
Google has the right to have commercial services, but not under a monopoly situation.
Today's vote is non-binding. It won't force Google to unbundle. But lawyer Kevin Poulter says it's aimed at the European Commission, which, after 4 years, is still carrying out an antitrust probe into the company.
What the Parliament's trying to do is to apply that little bit more pressure to the Commission. The European Parliament is starting to swing their weight around and say, we want some action taken.
Google says it's made 3 offers to the Commission to remedy the situation, but all have been rejected. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The 12 members of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, better known as OPEC, are meeting today in Vienna. The backdrop is falling oil prices. They've fallen by a third since June, and today they hit 4-year lows. OPEC has the power to limit or increase production, to adjust its target of 30 million barrels a day to try to bring prices up or down. Jamie Webster is Senior Director for Oil Markets at IHS, and he's in Vienna for today's meeting. How you doing, Jamie?
Not bad, not bad.
What are these guys trying to hammer out there in Vienna?
So OPEC is meeting as a, you know, this is their regular meeting, but you're in a much different environment than you've been in the last couple of years, where prices are so much lower, so they're really trying to decide, should we cut, how much should we cut, or should we just roll it over the 30 million barrel a day target they've had for the last couple of years and just kind of see, you know, is the market going to kind of level itself without any outside act?
Well, help me understand that target. I understand it's a 30 million barrel a day target, but these countries have been exceeding that.
Yeah, so the total production has been above that 30 million barrel a day target pretty much since they put that target in, which isn't that unusual. But this one is a little bit tougher because it's a organization-wide target, and you've got 12 countries in there, so there isn't anything that indicates what country should be producing what. So you can't tell who is overproducing.
Where is the tension here? How contentious a debate is this, do you think?
There's definitely a wing that seems to believe, you know, we'll just let markets kind of do their own thing. We can handle lower prices, and that's certainly something that I would say Saudi Arabia is communicating. And then others, like Venezuela, is in a much worse position. Their social spending is such that they were in trouble even when prices were at $105, $110. So now they're, you know, really suffering with this lower prices, and they are definitely wanting some sort of action, and they want it sooner rather than later.
Jamie Webster is Senior Director for Oil Markets at IHS. We've reached him on the phone from Vienna, where OPEC is meeting. Jamie, thanks very much.
Certainly, Dave.
And let's do the numbers. At last check, a barrel of light sweet crude was trading at $72.45. The markets are open in Europe. The FT 100 is up 0.25% at 67.46. France's CAC 40 is also up. It's at 4,394. U.S. markets are, of course, closed for the Thanksgiving holiday, but the major market indices finished the day yesterday at record highs. The Dow at 17,827. The S&P just above 2,072.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Nuance Power PDF, designed for powerful business functionality that's scalable for the entire organization. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Tennessee is about to become the first state in the country to pay for every student to go to community college. Turns out the offer is about marketing as much as it's about money. Thousands of the students who applied last month for the state's program qualified for federal scholarships that would cover their tuition. They just didn't realize it. Emily Siner from WPLN in Nashville filed this report.
Here's a refrigerator magnet for you.
And a small swarm of teenagers and parents are lining up in front of Sydney Simpson, who's with the Volunteer State Community College Office of Admissions.
And if you want to have a seat right there, they'll get going in a tour just in a second.
After the tour, the high school seniors grab seats in the library's computer lab. Staff members are guiding them through the Tennessee Promise application, and everyone there said something similar to this.
I mean, why not? It's free, you know? And college is not cheap.
I mean, who doesn't like free?
That's Aaron Drexler, a homeschooled high school senior, and Helen Bird, a parent who's sitting nearby. And they're not the only ones who feel this way. Nearly every high school senior in the state has applied. Now, many of those students won't actually attend community college next fall. Some will decide to go to a four-year school instead or not go to college at all. But Mike Krause, the program's executive director, says this is still big.
I've been in Tennessee government now for 8 years, and in higher education specifically. I have never seen this level of conversation around going to college.
Here's how Tennessee Promise works. Students have to first apply for federal financial aid, and the state just pays whatever tuition is left over. The kicker is, Tennessee is expecting that about half of these kids will get their tuition covered by federal grants, not by the state at all. That means they could have gone to college for free even without Tennessee Promise. But Krause says a lot of them just didn't realize these grants were available.
They say, I can't afford college, and they shrug. Tennessee Promise, so far, I think the most powerful effect has been to change that conversation.
In other words, Tennessee Promise is an experiment in college marketing as much as funding, and other cities and states are watching to see how successful the program will be. Back at Volunteer State, high school senior Madison Cohn is signing the final paperwork for her Tennessee Promise application.
Because I'm all about saving money.
Cohn's mother had to take out student loans to get through college. For the two of them, free is a message they really want to hear. In Nashville, I'm Emily Siner for Marketplace.
Finally, it seems more celebrities want to moonlight as venture capitalists. Carmelo Anthony runs Mellow 7 Tech Partners, and Justin Bieber, he's invested at least $500,000 in a selfie app called Shots. And the Biebs investment may pay off. There are reports Twitter is interested in buying the app, reports that were fueled by a cryptic tweet Twitter's CFO accidentally sent, thinking it was a direct message. Gotta watch that. In New York, I'm David Gura with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on WPR this Thanksgiving morning. Just ahead, there's music for the holiday, and then at noon, we have two special programs for you. And you can hear All Things Considered as usual with your host, Kristen Durst, starting at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Madison, offering bird seed, accessories, and advice to bring song, color, and birds to Wisconsin's backyards. WBUMadison.com. Discover a refuge in your own backyard.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, presenting Good Tidings of Great Joy, based on the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, Saturday evening at the Siena Center in Racine, and again on Monday evening, December 8th, at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Waterford. Tickets at choralartsonline.org. You're listening to WGTD HD.